Okay, well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me. I hope there are a lot of baseball fans here, but even if they're not, my specialty is baseball literature. I host a blog called Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, where I write about not only books, but music, movies, pop culture. So pretty much anything that has to do with baseball and can fit literally on a bookshelf is fair game. All right, so as we were talking, the World Series is going to end tonight one way or the other.
Oh, is that right?
One way. This is Game 7. Game 7. So, as I said, the Cubs haven't won in 108 years, and the Indians haven't won since 1948. So whoever wins is going to be an historic occasion. And if the past is any indication, there are going to be books about this, about the World Series and or the teams. In fact, a look at Amazon shows that there are already a couple books coming out about the Cubs. As soon as they won the pennant, the Chicago Tribune goes through their stories and they decide to make some more money off of what they've already done, and they put out a commemorative book that they know all the fans are going to buy. So whoever wins are probably going to get an extra boost because they'll probably have a book about the manager of the Cubs and what a wonderful job he's done. The general manager of the Cubs is the same guy who won with the Boston Red Sox in 2004 to break their 86-year-long streak without a world championship. So I just want to read a little bit from the introduction to the book, which talks about why baseball is such a sport that's written about so much. In his introduction to the Norton Book of Sports, George Plimpton described his small ball theory of literature. Plimpton, who served as the editor for the anthology, believed there was a correlation between the standard of writing about a particular sport and the ball that it utilizes, that the smaller the ball, the more formidable the literature. Accordingly, since natural pastime employs one of the smaller pieces of sporting equipment, there may have been very good books about baseball, he wrote. Sure, it's a cliche to say that baseball is a metaphor for life, but precisely that notion is reflected in the wide range of genres, from fiction to philosophy, statistics to science, and biographies to business, among others. Perhaps it's the leisurely pace of the game, stretched out over several hours and played during the languid days of summer, that lends baseball to the printed word. The Hall of Fame Library in Cooperstown boasts a collection of more than 10,000 volumes dating back to the early 19th century, and the Library of Congress has similar holdings. Just as there are David McCullough, Stephen King's, John Clancy's, and Agatha Christie's in the so-called real literacy world, there are similar staples of baseball. W.P. Kinsella, who recently passed away in fiction, Peter Gallenbach for team and oral histories, Donald Honig for general histories, Harold Seymour and David Q. Voigt for their multi-volume histories of the national pastime, and John Thorne, who was recently appointed official historian for Major League Baseball. The books listed in my book represent some of the best and most publicized and the quirkiest examples of this kind of literature. But even if you don't like baseball, within the genre of baseball literature, there are things you're going to find that you probably enjoy. For history, let's say. The history of immigrants to the United States is rooted in acceptance. And how do you become accepted? You do things that Americans do. And what do Americans do? They play baseball. So every immigrant group that came here, the Germans, the Italians, the Irish, the Jews, wanted to become American. They did that through baseball. And they gradually gained acceptance. Some it took longer than others. Even African Americans who were born in this country, you're talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers, you had Jackie Robinson, of course. You had Larry Doby, who played for the Cleveland Indians a few months later, also 1947. But you never hear about Dan Bankhead, who was the first pitcher, the first African-American pitcher in the major leagues. And if you're not first, it's almost as if you never did anything. So, like I said, there's literally something for everybody. I'm constantly doing research on what's coming up. So in 2017, one of the books I'm most looking forward to is a book about the making of The Pride of the Yankees. Is everybody familiar with that movie? It's the Lou Gehrig story, starring Gary Cooper, Walter Brennan, Dan Duryea, Teresa Wright. And it is, of course, you didn't have to sanitize it because Lou Gehrig was a hero in those days before you had performance-enhancing drugs, and he wasn't even the kind of hero that Babe Ruth was, because he was a very quiet fellow. He was someone who a lot of people looked up to. Because he was so quiet, he didn't go out gambling and drinking and carousing. So this book is written by Richard Sandomir, who is the sports media columnist for the New York Times. So going back a little bit, I mentioned the books that are coming out that will probably be coming out next year about the Cubs, let's say, because, again, even if they lose tonight, the fact that they've gotten to the World Series is a major accomplishment. So there are the political columnist George F. Well, if you're familiar with his work, Ira Burko, who used to write for the New York Times, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, grew up in Chicago. Bill Murray, the comedian, who probably jinxed the Cubs by leading him in the singing of Take Me Out to the Ball Game the other night, is a big fan. So I wouldn't be surprised if, on the spur of the moment, in the height of the celebration, they get together and write a few essays, and then they're all put together in a compendium and released next year. Talking about America, baseball, and history, there is an excellent book. And one of the problems with a book like mine is that as soon as it's put out, it changes. Because just like the history books, the statistics books, if somebody comes along and breaks a record, you have to literally rewrite the history books. So this book came out in 2013. So since then, you get an average of, and I'm talking quality baseball books, not books written for kids or fictional books written with other audiences in mind that just basically touch on baseball. But you're going to have around 200 books a year that come out. And out of those, you have two or three excellent books. There are organizations that hand out awards for the best in baseball literature. Sabre, the group to which I belong, hands out several, because that's their forte, is research. And it's always surprising the amount of research that is still to be discovered. Next year, there's going to be a new biography about Casey Stengel and Leo DeRocher, formerly with the Yankees and the Dodgers. And you would think, both of these gentlemen have long since passed, and you would think, well, what more can be written? Well, we're living in an age right now, the Internet age, that allows the kind of research that could never have been done before. Things are digitized, old newspapers are digitized and put online, so you don't have to go traveling to far-off places around the country. You can do the research in the comfort of your own home. My new book on Hank Greenberg in 1938 comes out next spring, and I was able to do basically all of my research because, realistically speaking, there's nobody left to talk to who was there at the time. The primary resources are not available, so you go to secondary resources, which are previously written books and newspapers. And that was the most fascinating part of the research, is going to the newspapers from across the country and not just reading the sports section, but looking at the front page and seeing what was important to each of those communities. In those days, there were only 16 teams in the major leagues, and there were several cities that had more than one team. New York had three teams. St. Louis had two teams. Boston had two. Philadelphia had two. So it was pretty compact, and there's always something, always something to read about those players. So this is 1938, so it's at the dawning, let's say, of World War II. So the front pages of the papers early in the year were mostly local things that were going on. It's the tail end of the Depression, so you still have economic situations that affect the people of these major metropolitan areas. Greenberg played in Detroit. Detroit was the home of the Ford Motor Company, and perhaps no other industry in the country took a hit as the automobile industry. So Detroit was hit especially hard by the Depression. But as the year went on, more and more news came out about what was going on in Europe. You might start earlier in the year, page 456, but by October, when the baseball season was winding down, the World Series was starting, there were banner headlines about Germany invading Austria, Germany invading Czechoslovakia, the responses of the other European nations, France, England, to what was going on at the time. So, as I say, even if you're not a strong baseball fan, you can see how it was affecting other areas. And within a few years, once America got into the war, the Commissioner of Baseball wrote a letter to President Roosevelt asking, what should we do? We have thousands of young men who are getting ready to go to spring training in the minor leagues and the major leagues. What should we do? And Roosevelt wrote back, this was in January of 1942, and Roosevelt wrote back immediately that for the sake of the morale of the country, baseball should go on as uninterrupted as possible. So you have people like Hank Greenberg, who lost 3 full years and parts of 2 others to serve in active duty in World War II. You have Joe DiMaggio, who lost time. You had Ted Williams, who served in in the Air Corps,
Marine Corps,
in both World War II and Korea. So he lost major time. And, you know, when you're an athlete, it's not like any other industry. You have a very narrow window of opportunity. You know, pretty much by the time you're in your mid-30s, you're in decline. So for these men to volunteer, Ted Williams and Hank Greenberg and Bob Feller and people like that enlisted. They didn't wait to be drafted. So there are plenty of wonderful books about American service during World War II, and all the biographies about these gentlemen include very proudly the information about their service. So, again, Casey Stengel, Leo DeRocher, there are other biographies of lesser players and personnel who are coming out. Anniversaries make for wonderful topics. 2017 is the 100th anniversary that Babe Ruth set the first home run record, the first to hit 60 home runs. So the purpose of my book on Hank Greenberg in 1938, he was challenging that record. No one else had come as close as 54 home runs before. And there is what was going on in Europe, what was going on at home, how he was being treated. There are a lot of people who think that toward the end of the year, he didn't get the kind of pitches that he ordinarily would have gotten because he was a Jew, and they didn't want a Jew breaking Babe Ruth's record. It's similar to Hank Aaron in 1974, and he was approaching the career record. They didn't want a black man breaking the record of a white man. So all these things make for interesting readings, and especially as you move from books that were written in the 40s and 50s and 60s and how they reflect the time that they were written and the attitudes, the racial attitudes, the religious attitudes, historical and economic attitudes, you see how that changes over the years, now, whether it's due to the new things you can find out with research or just the attitudes of the writers who grew up in a different era and how they think of what came all those years before. It's something always interesting to find. And with that, I open the floor to questions or comments. And thank you for your attention. Sir?
When did the Dodgers really leave Brooklyn?
Okay, you have...
The secret story.
A lot of these things lend themselves to conspiracy theories. One of the... It comes down to money. It comes down to money. They wanted a better ballpark. They wanted a dome stadium. They wanted it set up in the where the Atlantic Avenue subway stations are. Yeah, exactly. So they wanted that then. Robert Moses, who is the architect of New York, was in a battle with the Dodger hierarchy, Branch Rickey and the O'Malleys, and basically came down to money. And they didn't want to build it there unless they were recompensed somehow. You also have the attitude of this is the post-war years, and you have a changing demographic in Brooklyn. The more affluent white citizens were moving out to the suburbs, and their places in the inner city were being taken over by black and Hispanic people. And the Yankees were one of the last teams to bring up an African-American ball player with Elston Howard.
He didn't come up until like 1955, I think. This is like 8 years after Jackie Robinson. Willie Mays was the first black player for the Giants in 1951. The Yankees notoriously didn't want black fans coming out to the ballpark. They basically didn't want their upscale white customers sitting next to black people. So that's basically why the Dodgers left. And it's funny, you mentioned the Dodgers. No one really talks about the Giants. The Giants left New York also. The Giants left.
Wouldn't find Coogan's Bluff.
The Giants.
I don't know where Coogan's Bluff.
I mean, evidently it's right, like spitting distance from Yankee Stadium on the other side of the Harlem River. But you never hear about the Giants. The Giants basically went to California so the Dodgers would have someone close by to play with. Because when you also think about what that meant as far as every team before then was east of Missouri. That was the farthest point west, and it was, but now you have teams on the West Coast, so you have the 3-hour time difference, and you have to get them over to the East Coast, and the effect that has, that's still a complaint now. They're saying when they set up schedules for baseball now, they're saying like some teams have an unfair advantage because they play in an area that's more concentrated, but they still have to make the trip, and then they have to come back. And the Players Association has rules as to what you can do, you know, the travel time and days off and whatnot. But to answer your question, money. Money's the answer to everything.
All right, I got one. Why did the Boston Braves leave Boston? Well, Boston could support a number of
them. But that was always, especially during the Depression. Well, first of all, the Boston Braves were a notoriously bad team. They didn't have the... I mean, the Red Sox weren't... spent a great many years in also bad. They were the last team to have a black player, and then some say that teams that were late in putting black players on their roster were doing themselves a disservice because these were good players. So they were having bad white players at the expense of having good black players. So... The gentleman whose name I forget, who was in charge of the Red Sox, the Braves at the time, had an opportunity to go to Milwaukee. Milwaukee was a baseball town. They were desperate for a major league team. They had the minor league team there, but they were desperate for a major league team. And you had to show that you had enough of an audience that was willing to come out and spend money and go to the ballpark. And this is 2017 will be the 60th anniversary of the first world championship for the Milwaukee Braves. So, again, Milwaukee is in the heartland. It's like right next to Chicago. You don't hear too much about it because it's not New York and it's not Los Angeles.
It's a small stadium, too. I used to love going down watching the Braves.
Yeah. The Bud Selig. No. Bud Selig. Grew up with the Milwaukee Braves. He was his family owned a car, very large car dealership, and and he got involved with the Braves, and then became commissioner of baseball. While he was commissioner of baseball, he was acting commissioner of baseball after Peter Ueberroth left. I think it was Ueberroth. There might have been somebody in between Ueberroth and Selig, but while he was commissioner, acting commissioner, he still was in charge of the team. Which was, he handed it off to his daughter to run the team in his absence.
He owned a Cadillac dealership, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, to date you, when I was in Revere, Massachusetts, at 11 years old, I took my brother on a bus to the Boston Braves game, and there was no hitter. I was going to think this was cool. And I'm amazed that at 11 years old, those days was fine.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Today, forget about it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, but, well, okay, no trouble.
Look, even when I was a kid, like 12, 13 years old, you know, I hopped on the subway and went to Shea Stadium. Yeah, it was not a big deal. And I actually, when I was between the ages of 8 and 10, I lived in Crown Heights.
Oh, yes.
Around the corner, basically, from where Ebbets Field used to be.
Right.
And for as many aerial pictures as I've seen of the layout of the ballpark with the streets listed. I still can't figure out where it was. I can't picture it in my head. Where, you know, I was Bedford Avenue.
Bedford Avenue.
Right. Rogers, President Street, all around right. there.
Empire Boulevard.
And right. I just can't.
Still have the plaque there.
Yep, the Jackie Robinson apartments.
Well, I went to high school at Brookwood Prep, which was 3 blocks away. It was in Crown Heights. It was, what was the address?
Was that on
Ocean?
Was it Crescent? No, it was
Rogers.
Rogers and...
I was thinking Notion Avenue.
No, not Notion. It's right into Clark's. I'll get it. It'll come out. But anyway, Lee McPhail was the traveling secretary for the Dodgers. His son was in my class in 1956. I got out of Brooklyn Prep in 1956, so I went there, started in 53. So Lee McPhail, we used to have to go to school in blazer, shirt, tie, and overgame. And we go behind the dugout, or there was an entranceway right between the dugout and home plate, and we'd be, somebody meet us at the door, three, four of us, and we'd get in, and we wouldn't have box seats, but we'd be right behind where the catchers were, you know, like two or three aisles back, and it was really quite exciting. We could get in there. You know, class ended at 2:45 or something like that. 3 blocks walking, we'd be over there. And then there were the Dodgers right in front of us.
And what'd you pay for a ticket?
We didn't pay.
Oh, you didn't pay at all?
Didn't pay at all.
Unless the arrest.
Right. But then when we were, you know, not in school, I used to remember Happy Phelps Diehole Gang and used to get in for 50 cents. Used to take the subway for a nickel or a dime and come there and walk in, and you could work your way down to, you know, pretty decent seats. I mean, there were, during the week, there wasn't, you know, that many all the seats filled up. You know, when they were starting to play the Giants big time well, you could never get a seat during World Series time. But, 50 cents was the ticket number, and you know, you could get pretty decent seats. You know, my father, you know, had a couple of extra bucks, but $3, you got pretty decent seats.
One of the best baseball books of all time is called A Day in the Bleachers by Arnold Hano. It's and the way it came about, he was a sports writer, wrote for magazines, basically. The way it came about, he lived in Manhattan. He told his wife one day, the first game of the, well, I don't know if it was the first game. It was the game of the catch, Willie Mays catch off Vic Wertz. If you're not familiar with
Mays
that,
Mays catch was 1954.
54.
In World Series.
Yeah. So he just decided on the spur of the moment that he was going to go to a World Series game. Can you imagine that now? Okay. And he went online, got online, and was able to buy a ticket.
Right.
He sat in the bleachers, and he was able to witness this, and the fact that he was able to recount this, remember, he's sitting there live. He doesn't have the benefit of watching it on TV where they show endless replays from endless angles. So, and for him to craft a book based on that one incident, and it's still 60 years later, a bestseller, is pretty remarkable.
I grew up in upstate Connecticut, which was doing minor league territory. That's where everybody knew. Nobody paid attention to majors. And I kind of lost track. But how important really today is the minors to the majors?
Today?
Yeah. Are they thriving or not?
They're thriving because it's like Faith and I used to go to minor league games. We build that into our vacation.
We used to go every week.
And it's becoming more major league. I'm kind of surprised and disappointed because it used to be, even 20 years ago, you could go get a really cheap seat, really cheap concessions, and enjoy the game. And now, like a lot of major league teams, what they're doing is they're making it, I don't mean this to sound as bad as it's going to, they're making it family friendly. They're making it for people who don't like baseball. It's like if you're married to somebody who doesn't like baseball and you have kids and you want to go see a game, you take everybody to the game, You know, the wife can go to one of the wonderful restaurants that they have there. The kids can go to the arcade, and you can watch the game if you don't mind being blasted by all the music that they play every minute in between pitches. The minor leagues in the time of the Hank Greenberg book were in a little bit of a decline because of economics. Teams couldn't afford to have all the affiliates that they had. The St. Louis Cardinals with Branch Rickey, who later went to the Dodgers, had like 20 minor league teams. They had 750 players alone in their system. There were thousands and thousands of players in the minors. These days, it's still, I suppose if you live in that community, like if you live in Durham and you go see the Durham Bulls, you know, they have a long history of faithful fans. It's obviously still important to the teams because those are the training grounds to the future stars. So, but it's much more like everything else these days. It's much more of an economic thing. It's like when you're a kid and you say, oh, they get paid to play baseball? I would play for nothing. And then when you get older, you see that, well, yeah, everything, you got to get paid for everything. And then that's what it is now. It's disappointing, but it's reality.
Ron, I have one question. Does the altitude of many of these playing fields have any impact on them?
Supposedly, yeah. The Colorado Rockies play in Mile High Stadium, which is, as the name suggests. And there have always been theories that in the thinner air, the ball travels farther. And that's why a lot of purists contest the fact that they hit so many home runs. Well, yeah, if you have those ideal conditions, you know, you can't compare. There are a few players they had whose home run totals are relatively high. And once they retire, they say, well, gee, you know, he's got all these home runs. Maybe he should be considered for the Hall of Fame. But you realize if he was playing anywhere else, and there are all these new statistics that they use to try to equalize, normalize what he would do in an average setting. Like, would he be as good if he were playing in Fenway Park? Or would he be as good as some other stadium that doesn't have the advantage of the atmosphere?
Are you familiar with the, I get a chance during the summer to go to a couple of games on Cape Cod.
The Cape Cod League.
I was amazed at how good the players are.
That's one of the stepping stones to professional baseball because they use wooden bats. When I was in college, that was the time where college teams started using metal bats because they were cost effective. Again, you know, they don't break. You know, and you could buy two or three, and they would last for years. Players would share. But to get a good sense of how the players are going to do, you need them to be using wooden bats. So, yeah, there are a couple of good books. The Last Best League is a book written about the Cape Cod League. It's an excellent book for that.
There's a museum dedicated, or a plural, one of the museums in Hyannis dedicated to the league. It's well done, small, but it's an interesting museum.
Mm-hmm. If I may,
sure.
I have a friend of mine that he belongs in this organization. He said to me he's a baseball enthusiast. He said, you won't believe it, but the owner of the Yankees got a mortgage for Boston Red Sox field because they were going bankrupt.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And he had the mortgage.
Yeah, that's how the Yankees got Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Because the guy who was running the Boston Red Sox, Harry Frazee, or Frazee, depending on how you want to pronounce his name, he was very heavy into show business. He was a producer of Broadway shows. And he put every spare penny he had into his Broadway shows, and some did better than others. So to keep financing those things, he had to come up with money. So he started selling off some of his players. And Babe Ruth broke into baseball in the major leagues as a pitcher for the Boston Red Sox back in the early 1910s, 1912 maybe, 1914. And there have been tons of books written about Babe Ruth, perhaps more books than any other single player except Jackie Robinson. And the stories of his upbringing, his childhood in orphanage, for lack of a better word. It wasn't a real orphanage, but it was a place where kids were sent when their parents, home for incorrigibles. And he grew up there. He was didn't have a normal childhood, so when he got out of that orphanage at the age of 18, because a baseball executive discovered him and wanted him to play, he went crazy. You know, he had all this freedom that he never had before. So he had money, he had fame, he bought multiple cars, which he didn't know how to drive, so he got numerous traffic accidents. He drank, he smoked, he had women, et cetera, et cetera, and he got to a point where his demands, his salary demands were too much for the Red Sox, so that's how he came to the Yankees, because Frizzy needed the money, so he ended up, you know, swapping the mortgage for Fenway to get them to pay for Ruth.
The gentleman had to cancel the mortgage.
Well, that's a collector's item.
That, yeah.
The clubs must be having some economic problems. I wouldn't take up a collection. But my brother works for the Red Sox, and they, after the game ends, they extended the bars in the stadium to be open for another 2 hours to get revenue.
Really?
The Yankees are going to do the same thing.
That's interesting, because one of the things that Bill Murray said when he was about to start take me out to the ball game was it's the seventh inning, the last inning you can buy beer. Because some of the stadiums don't want people driving home under the influence, so they shut down beer sales. Maybe they shut them down from the concessionaires going through the stadium, and you can still buy them in the interior of the ballpark. But that's surprising, because that's...
Yeah, no, they keep it open, you know, with the anomaly, you go up and grab a beer.
Yeah. Look, I mean, somebody's got to pay these ridiculous salaries. You got to finance it somehow. And, you know, ticket prices, the new stadiums, everybody wants new stadiums because then you can have luxury suites.
Yes.
They can charge it.
The ladies there at this stadium that make the most money are the ladies that work in our area, because guys go up and they throw a 20 down, yep, and the beer is $9 or whatever.
And that's a cheap beer at $9.
Well, I don't drink that much.
Well, as a postscript to that, I think having that the wine bar, so to speak, open from the old stadium, Yankee Stadium, I don't think the new one makes too much of a difference because of the surrounding neighborhood. At the end of the game, first of all, it would be very difficult to get your car to get out. And so you say, let me, because you couldn't get anything in the stadium at that particular point. Couldn't even fall asleep in the stadium at that point. So you had to kind of walk up towards the concourse. And that was pretty much taking your life in your hands. So if you could go to any place of refuge in the fortress for a while, and the car's clear, that would be a great benefit.
Is that why I didn't see you on the way out?
You have to join the muggers.
Yeah.